This is the Does God Exist Bi-Monthly Journal for the Visually Impaired for May-June 2015. John Clayton is your reader. This particular issue of our Bi-Monthly Journal has a picture of a nebula in outer space with a blue center and red surrounding as material moves out from a star that has exploded. And our theme for this issue is the new astronomy and God. And our first article introduces that. We live in an age of incredible advances in science and technology. As I watch children doing amazing things with their phones and their computers, I'm reminded of how things were when I was a kid. I remember seeing my first television set at an Electricity in the Future display at the Indiana State Fair in Indianapolis in 1946. The 6-inch picture tube flickered and jumped around, but that black and white image was amazing to me and to the hundreds of other people who saw this technology being introduced. I also remember the first time I used a telephone that was not a party line. As a kid, all the phones in the neighborhood were on the same line. When you talked to someone on the phone, everyone in the neighborhood could listen in and even make comments. I make those kinds of remarks now in the presence of my grandchildren, and they think I'm just making up stories. The implications of the rapid change in technology have also had a huge impact on science. One science that has seen a rapid growth of factual information is astronomy. I've been a witness to much of that change as well, because as a science teacher, I was always interested in what we understood about space. I saw Sputnik from my backyard as a teenager. As a science major in college and as a pilot teacher in the Earth Science Curriculum Project, I took large numbers of classes supported by the National Science Foundation. Those classes brought us up to date on the latest advances in space and provided us with techniques to teach these exciting new discoveries to our students. Today, astronomy is still expanding its horizons. We now have instruments that can see much further into space and with much greater clarity than we could even 10 years ago. New telescopes have been constructed all over the world, and special telescopes exist that see in different parts of the spectrum than what we could observe in the past. Ultraviolet, infrared, X-ray, radio waves of all wavelengths, and even devices that see neutrinos and quarks are now either in operation or under development. I put emphasis on the word see because we perceive them, but not with our eyes. All of those things are the same kind of radiation, but we don't actually use our eyes to perceive some of them. We are now looking at other solar systems orbiting stars far away from our sun and its set of planets. We are able now to see objects much further away than we ever could before, because we have telescopes that gather much more light than those of the past. I recently heard an astronomer at a conference tell his audience that if someone standing on the surface of the moon lit a match, or a light equivalent to a match, our telescopes could see it from our vantage point on Earth. Some of the light we are seeing is so far away that it left its source at a time very close to the creation of the cosmos. What is amazing about all of this advancement in astronomy is that all this growth has added to the volume of evidence that God is the creator and the sustainer of the universe. The media tends to project all of this advancement as a threat to faith. Programs like the recent Cosmos series with Neil deGrasse Tyson devoted a great deal of time to showing that historically religious people were very wrong in their understandings about the creation, and in some cases may have impeded science by their religious misunderstandings. The Roman Catholic Church is frequently vilified in this regard, and the incident with Galileo is well publicized as a demonstration of what is wrong with religion. In reality, there were some moral issues involved in Galileo's situation that were more of a concern to the religious leaders of the day than his scientific views. But even in moral issues, religion can be wrong. It is not what a denomination believes or teaches that is the issue in asking whether God is the creator of the cosmos. The question is what the evidence shows, not what philosophers and theologians believe. The Roman Catholic Church has changed its position on science and faith enormously in the last century. In 1950, Pope Pius XII proclaimed there was no opposition between evolution and Catholic doctrine. And in 1996, Pope John Paul II repeated and endorsed that view. In October of 2014, Pope Francis issued a position paper that showed a good understanding of the relationship between science and faith in the 21st century. The Pope said, and I quote, "When we read about creation in Genesis, we run the risk of imagining God was a magician with a magic wand, able to do everything. But that is not so." He went on to say that the beginning of the world was not a work of chaos, and that God is not a magician, but a creator who brought everything to life. That's a quote, incidentally, from the Huffington Post on October 27, 2014. What the new astronomy is telling us is how much greater, wiser, and more intelligent God has been in his creation of our world than we ever imagined. Here are a few of the new understandings that we have gained in recent years. The first one is the creation is even greater than we imagined in size and in energy. The size of the cosmos staggers the imagination. Right now, our measurements tell us that the distance from the Earth to the edge of space is 14 with nine zeros after it, 14 billion light years. If you could travel at the speed of light, it would take 14 billion years to get to the edge of the creation. And by that time, it would have expanded much further out. To translate that into miles would involve multiplying the speed of light, which is 186,000 miles per second, by the number of seconds in 47 billion years. In addition to telling us about the incredible size of the creation, we now know that energy involved in the creation is massively beyond anything we imagined. In the old astronomy, we could calculate the energy in the creation by multiplying the amount of matter in the cosmos by the speed of light squared, using Einstein's famous equation E equals mc squared. We now know that this figure would only be about 4.5% of the actual energy in the creation. That is because 95.5% of the energy of the creation is involved in dark matter and dark energy that we didn't even know existed 50 years ago. It is impossible for the human mind to completely grasp the size and amount of energy in the creation. And in all explanations of creation, we'd have to be able to embrace both features. Whatever your concept of God was when you were a child, it should now be massively larger and grander. Today, modern astronomy has added a whole new dimension to, quote, "the heavens declare the glory of God, and the skies proclaim the work of his hands." Our second point is that the complexity of creation is far greater than we ever dreamed it could be. Most of us have heard the title Big Bang used to describe what appears to be the history of the cosmos. Frederick Hoyle invented the term while making fun of the model of the cosmos that researchers were promoting, and the name stuck. The Big Bang doesn't tell you what banged or who banged it. What it does is describe the pattern of motion and energy change that we see in the cosmos with our newest telescopes. In March of 2014, researchers announced the discovery of gravity waves. This discovery would open the door to uniting quantum mechanics and gravity into a workable explanation of the process of creation. What all of this is telling us is that before the creation process could even start, there had to be certain things that had to be in place. Time had to be created and have a particular direction. Space had to be created and with a proper shape. Space could be spherical, saddle-shaped, or flat. Which shape was chosen would radically affect how the creation would function and how long it would last. Space had to be created so that it could expand, and the expansion rate had to be precisely chosen. The evidence is that the entire universe was contained in a point a billionth the size of a nuclear particle. In less than a nanosecond, that's 10 to the minus 9 seconds, the energy would fill the universe with quarks, and in 0.01 milliseconds, the quarks would clump into protons and neutrons. This is the current model of the process of creation, based on the evidence available in 2014. It is highly likely that this model is wrong, or at least incomplete. New evidence will change our understanding in the years ahead. So why even discuss it? A few years ago, words like quark and gravity waves were unknown. the wisdom and intelligence and power that is necessary to do such a simple thing as producing atoms gives us a picture of God as the Creator. In Proverbs 8:22-23, we find wisdom speaking. Wisdom says, quote, "The Lord possessed me at the beginning of his work, before his deeds of old. I was appointed from eternity," eternity meaning before there was time, "from the beginning, before the world began." The new astronomy shows us God's amazing wisdom and intelligence. As our knowledge grows, our appreciation of God as an engineer expands. Our third point is that the cosmos contains far more features than we thought that had to be designed for life to exist. One of the major thrusts of the new astronomy has been to find other planets orbiting stars other than our sun. Our improved technology has shown us more than 1,800 planets orbiting other stars. This is no surprise to scientists. One of the design features of matter is that it attracts other matter. If two astronauts were floating free in space with no other masses around, they would be drawn together by gravity and would orbit one another if they didn't collide. The creation is full of matter, and all of that matter experiences mutual gravitational pull throughout the cosmos. The sun and the moon both pull on water in our oceans, producing a multiplicity of tides, depending upon the relative positions of the sun, moon, and earth. What is remarkable about all the exoplanets, in other words, planets orbiting stars other than our sun, is that we are seeing how special and extraordinary our Earth is. Newspaper articles might suggest in their headlines that hundreds of Earth-like planets have been discovered. Every time a planet is found in the Goldilocks zone, in other words, the zone in which the planet's location would allow water to exist as a liquid, that planet would be identical to the Earth. For every star in the creation, there is a distance from it that would allow a temperature range between 0 and 100 degrees Celsius, the freezing and boiling point of water. That has led some to speculate that there must be billions of planetary systems out there with life like ours. The fact is that the distance from a star is only one of many variables that must be carefully chosen for life to exist. And please note here that we're talking about carbon-based, oxygen-based life in this discussion. It is virtually impossible for life based on a radically different chemistry to exist, and rock people or fire people violate the definition of what life is. Our studies of exoplanets have shown us that having a small, rocky planet large enough to retain an atmosphere is exceedingly rare. Having an orbit which is nearly circular, having a stable star, having a single star instead of a binary or trinary star, having adequate shielding from the dangers of interstellar space, and a variety of other factors are all necessary for life to exist. The unique character of planet Earth is hard to deny, and as more and more planets are discovered and studied, the evidence of the Earth's uniqueness continues to grow. Let us hasten to add here that we are not suggesting there is no life in space. If God created it, then it will be there. We are just pointing out that extrasolar planets have added more evidence of how unique our planet is. Our next point is that the nature of God as a being outside of space-time is real. Every time a modern astronomer starts exploring the meaning of their observations and equations, they find themselves encountering evidence of dimensions beyond the three dimensions in which we live. String theory proposes 11 spatial dimensions with 10 to the 500th power different possible solutions to the equations that describe string theory proposals. Similar results come from studies of the structure of matter and the implications of quantum mechanics. What is interesting about this is that the Bible has always presented God as a being outside of space-time. Consider this sampling of biblical descriptions of God. Jeremiah 23, verses 23 and 24. "Am I a God near at hand, says the Lord, and not a God afar off? Do I not fill heaven and earth, says the Lord?" 2 Chronicles 2 and verse 6. "But who is able to build God a house, seeing the heaven and earth of heavens cannot contain him?" Acts 17, verse 28, for in him we live and move and have our being. John 4, 24, God is a spirit. Numbers 23, verse 19, God is not a man that he should be. Revelation 22, 13, I am the Alpha and Omega, the first and the last, the beginning and the end. There's a tendency of mankind to visualize God as an old man with the same limitations and problems that we as humans have. When we put God into a human box and limit him to human abilities and understandings, we make our God too small to explain the creation as we see it. The new astronomy should expand our visualization of God and truly glorify him as the creator. The design features in the creation which allow us to live on this remarkable planet show us other attributes of God. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. That's Romans 1 and verse 20. And much of the data that we used here was taken from Scientific American in October of 2014, page 59, and in National Geographic in an article called Cosmic Questions in April of 2014. Do the heavens declare the glory of God? This is an article by Owen Gingerich, who is a Harvard professor of astronomy and history of science, a senior astronomer emeritus at the Smithsonian Astrophysical Observatory, the chairman of the International Astronomical Planet Identification Committee. And he delivered this sermon at a church in Tennessee, and it is reprinted with permission. Do the heavens declare the glory of God? Does the firmament show forth his handiwork? I'm sure you would be shocked if I simply said yes and sat down. On the other hand, you would all be even more stunned if I said no, the heavens don't declare the glory of God, and sat down. So I think you can safely deduce that there is something more to be said about the psalmist's ancient declaration. Back in my office at Cambridge, I have a considerable collection of early astronomy textbooks, mostly small and cheaply printed. What was then the recent invention of the letterpress printing made it possible for university students to have their very own copies of the textbook. That was particularly true at Martin Luther's University in Wittenberg, where the cheap small textbooks were essentially invented around 1530. So it's inspiring to have a shelf full of astronomy books written by authors who knew Martin Luther personally. In these books, I have placed my own bookplate, which includes the motto, Coela erunt gloriam Dei, the heavens are telling the glory of God, as translated in Haydn's Glorious Creation Oratorio. It's appropriate for my bookplate to be in Latin, since virtually all of the astronomy books from that period are written in Latin. When those authors looked up at the nighttime sky, they were perceiving a far different universe than we know today. They saw the moon and the stars that God had ordained. They knew the moon was 30 Earth diameters away. Actually, a pretty good reckoning. And they thought the sun was 20 times further, and therefore 20 times larger than the moon, since they both had the same apparent size during a solar eclipse. Actually, the sun is 400 times further, and therefore 64 million times larger in volume than the moon. Hell, deep inside the earth, was no doubt pretty much layered, as Dante had described it. And as for hellfire, there was evidence for that any time a volcano erupted. As for heaven itself, it lay just beyond the shell of stars that enclosed the planetary system. It was the habitable of the blessed, as the English astronomer Thomas Digges would describe it later in the century. So altogether, it was a pretty cozy universe. When Wittenberg astronomers looked up at the majestic Milky Way spanning the sky on a clear night, the sight was awesome, indeed glorious, and God was not so far away. His view and his appreciation was not all that different from the ancient psalmist himself. I, too, have witnessed the dazzling spangle of the Milky Way from the land of the psalmist. I vividly remember the vista from the dark setting east of the Dead Sea, where I could almost reach up and pluck a star of my own. And besides the brilliance of the Milky Way, there was much less common sight, the pyramid of a fainter glow in the west, the so-called zodiacal light, which I recognized as dust grains in the solar system reflecting the light of the sun. And to the east was the faint, fuzzy patch of the Andromeda Galaxy, an island universe 2 million light years away. It was the same sky the psalmist saw, or Luther saw. But in my 20th century understanding, the heavens were far vaster than either of them could have imagined. In both space and time, in my mind's eye, my universe was overwhelmingly different from the heavens they saw and envisioned. It was a long time ago that I was on the West Bank, seeing that star-filled sky, and we then did not know whether the universe stretched to a distant horizon 10 billion or 20 billion light years away. Today, we would put the horizon 13.7 billion light years away. And with the Hubble Space Telescope, we can record galaxies in their infancy, nearly that old, born of the Big Bang cataclysm that started it all in an inconceivably immense split-second blast of energy that Martin Luther's astronomers could barely have imagined. And so asking the question, do the heavens declare the glory of God? Today is not the same question. Errante coeli gloriam Dei that Martin Luther could have considered back in the days of Columbus, Leonardo da Vinci, or Copernicus. We are no longer in ecstasy about the beauty of creation, but we are instead crushed down by our insignificance in the vastness of the universe. Rather than Psalms 19, we return to Psalms 8. When I consider thy heavens, the work of thy fingers, the moon and the stars which thou hast ordained, what is man that thou art mindful of him? Where do we fit in as little specks in such an immense and ancient universe? More than once I have been asked, why does the universe have to be so big and so old? My answer is that I suppose the mighty Creator could have made the universe in many different ways, and our challenge as scientists is to discern how God did it. The mere fact that we creatures can ask this question tells us that there is a special relationship between ourselves as an intelligent species and the universe itself. Of the millions of species that have been or are now on the earth, we uniquely have the ability to ask this question of how the universe and we ourselves in it have come to be. The mere fact that such a question could be asked in itself gives us some hint that a creative intelligence lies behind this universe. As Genesis 1:27 says, quote, God created man in his own image, male and female created he them, end of quote. That's undoubtedly the most important verse in the whole first chapter of the Bible. God as Creator has endowed us with creativity in His own image, the ability to research, to imagine, to discover many fascinating details about the nature and origin of the universe. So what is the consequence of a universe being so old? Our universe is made of many different things, atoms, dark matter, and dark energy. And most of these we barely understand, apart from their being significant in the large-scale structure of the universe. But we know we wouldn't be here without atoms, and in particular, we need oxygen and carbon, the basis of organic chemistry. In the Big Bang, when pure energy was being turned into matter, huge amounts of the simplest atom, hydrogen, were being produced. That happened in the first 3 minutes. But carbon and oxygen were not made, so these and other atoms required for life were lacking. These critical elements came along much later through nuclear reactions in hot interiors of evolving giant stars, and they came about much, much more slowly. Sunday morning is probably not the best time for a lecture on nuclear physics, but there is one detail of the story that is really quite astonishing. The reason there wasn't any carbon in the initial brew. In principle, elements could be made by sticking simple hydrogen atoms together and going up the ladder to form heavier and heavier atoms. If basic hydrogen atoms have a mass of 1 unit, stick 2 together and you have heavy hydrogen with a mass of 2. Stick another to that and get the mass 3, and another for mass 4, which turns out to be the helium atom, and so on up the ladder to 12, which is the carbon atom. The problem is that mass 5 isn't stable. It almost always falls apart in a split second before another hydrogen can be added. So the process simply doesn't climb the ladder. In those first few minutes, the universe was cooling down so rapidly that the Big Bang was over before the heavier atoms had a chance to be formed. get around this obstacle requires lots more time, like billions of years. That's why we need a very old universe to get the building blocks for life. In the 1950s, the maverick British astronomer Fred Hoyle made some calculations about how much time it would take to cook up these critical elements in the cores of giant stars, and found that with ordinary structures in the nuclei of carbon and oxygen atoms, 10 billion years still wouldn't be enough time to make a significant quantities of these important elements. The missing mass 5 was a serious obstacle. But because we do have carbon and oxygen, there had to be something else going on. Some undiscovered feature in the structure of the carbon nucleus that raised the probability of its being formed. And Hoyle made a prediction of what that would be. There had to be what is called a resonance at a precise energy level in the carbon atom. Hoyle was, at that moment, on leave in Pasadena. So he went to physicist Wiley Fowler, who had access to an atom-smashing accelerator that could probe the nuclear resonance levels. Fowler thought it was kind of crazy that this visiting Englishman believed he could predict the inner structure of the carbon nucleus, but he agreed to try, and there it was. Not only was it there, but at precisely the right energy level, 4% lower, and there would essentially have been no carbon. Long ago, I heard rumors that nothing had shaken Hoyle's atheism as much as this discovery. From time to time, I had the occasion to discuss one thing or another with him, and never had quite enough nerve to say, "Fred, is it really true that the resonance level in the carbon atom has shaken your atheism? Do you believe the heavens declare the glory of God?" But an answer of sorts came when he wrote about his discovery on the Caltech Alumni Magazine as follows, quote, "Would you not say to yourself, some supercalculating intellect must have designed the properties of the carbon atom? Otherwise, the chance of my finding such an atom through the blind forces of nature would be utterly minuscule. Of course you would. A common sense interpretation of the facts suggests that a super intellect has monkeyed with physics, as well as with chemistry and biology, and that there are no blind forces worth speaking about in nature. The numbers one calculates from the facts seem to me so overwhelming as to put this conclusion beyond question." That is a truly remarkable quotation, especially considering the fact that Hoyle already had a reputation as a public skeptic. The numbers do give us some pause. If they had only slightly different values, we wouldn't be here. And these are not the only physical settings that are so subtly configured. The British Astronomer Royal, Martin Rees, has written a book titled Just Six Numbers. In it, he points out six numbers that describe our physical world, whose precise values are essential for a life-bearing universe. Tweak them only slightly, and our universe would be devoid of life. These and other very sensitively set numbers are what we refer to as fine-tuning. We have to be very pleased about this situation, since our existence depends upon it. Is the universe declaring something? That makes many of my physical friends very nervous. They don't like the idea of a supercalculating intellect tinkering with the universe. That wouldn't be natural. The universe wouldn't be entirely subject to physical laws they could discover. It would be supernatural, and that would be superstitious. When Isaac Newton described the role of gravity in keeping our moon in tow, this French scientist cried, "Superstitious! How could the earth affect the moon if nothing was touching it?" It was the same when Kepler proposed that the moon controlled the tides. Galileo declared, "I am surprised that the most astute Kepler gives rise to such superstitions. It doesn't disturb me that the universe could be designed for life, superstitious as that might be. I must warn you that I'm psychologically incapable of believing that the universe is purposeless." I like the analogy that the distinguished physicist John Wheeler proposed. He likened the universe to a giant plant whose purpose was ultimately to bring forth one small, delicate flower. Wheeler suggested that we are that one small flower of the universe, and that our destiny and purpose is to understand the universe. Perhaps the universe is designed to be understandable, and we as human beings are at work trying to understand the universe and its laws. The human brain is the single most complex thing we know about in the entire universe. What better instrument to contemplate the original universe? Ironically, our brains are complex enough even to contemplate the possibility that our brains might not be the most complex thing in the universe. But if our purpose in this universe is to understand God through the majesty of this universe, I have a problem. This opens us to a God of very large numbers. The energy required for the Big Bang is incomprehensibly large. As the physics is calculated back in time, the universe gets hotter and hotter. The elapsed time to the beginning of time itself becomes smaller and smaller. But the number gets huge in its teeniness. 10^-43 seconds before the physics runs out. And the time back to the beginning, nearly 14 billion years, is staggering. If you want to count to just 1 billion, two numbers per second, counting day and night, would take you 31 years. A God of very large numbers is impressive, but it is not a God we would choose to worship. A God of incomprehensible majesty? Yes. But try to understand that God is like a puppy trying to understand Isaac Newton. Is it just wishful thinking when we say that the heavens declare the glory of God? Well, wait a minute. A God of such magnificence and wisdom could well have power to limit itself, to wear a mask of himself or herself in order to relate to its creatures. And notice the word creatures. In itself, this carries the idea of our being created. Created creatures with the power to think theologically, to think inspired thoughts. If we regard God's world as the site of purpose and intention, and accept that we as surveyors of the universe are included in that intention, then the vision isn't complete without a role for divine communication. A place for God both as creator, sustainer, and as redeemer. A powerful transcendence which not only can be something, but can take on the mask of someone, a which that can connect us as a who. Such communication will be best expressed through personal relationships, through the wise voices and prophets in many times and places. The divine communication will carry a moral dimension, only dimly perceived in the grandeur of creation, yet present to the self-limitation of the Creator who has given both natural laws and freedom within its structure. Here, implications for human morality are discernible, for this view implies a self-renunciatory ethic. As Jesus said to Pilate, "My kingdom is not of this world. If my kingdom were of this world, then my followers would fight." Within the framework of Christianity, Jesus is the supreme example of personal communication from God, an exemplary life of service, of forgiveness, of sacrifice. When the apostle Philip requested, "Show us the Father," Jesus responded, "Anyone who has seen me has seen the Father." When Jesus, hanging on the cross and slowly suffocating, cried out, my God, why hast thou forsaken me?" The nature of God's self-limited world became excruciatingly clear. God acts within the world, but not always in the ways most obvious to our blinkered vision. This view of the central message of the Bible story is not closely tied to the heavens declaring the glory of God. Still, I can't help but remember the thrill I had as a 10-year-old when I was able to see the rings of Saturn with a simple telescope my father helped to build, and the excitement of sharing that view with my fourth grade teacher. Likewise, a year later, when I saw a stunning view of the moon with a 60-inch reflector on Mount Wilson, I had to be impressed with God's glory. But it was not just when I was a kid. Watching the eclipsing moon slowly move across the disk of the sun and then suddenly, like a light switch, turning off the light, the darkness and eclipsed sun, which you can admire directly without a dark filter, like a sparkling jeweled ring on a black velvet, it's enough to raise the pulse even higher. We know we're living at a very special time in the history of the universe, when the apparent size of the moon just covers the sun. In the far future, it won't look like this. But for now, it is one of the most breathtaking views from or on our planet. Yet I doubt that's enough to sway a skeptic, and perhaps that's how it should be. There's a telling passage in 1 Kings, quote, "And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind rent the mountains, and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, a still, small voice. End of quote. The message is in a still, small voice, God's inspiration. Literally, the bringing in of the Spirit. The glory of the heavens doesn't knock the skeptic from his perch. It's in the eye of the beholder. For me, the glory of the heavens inspires me to understand the handiwork of the Lord. However, it doesn't work for everyone. But let me quote a public skeptic in a little-known passage from Fred Hoyle, made near the end of his life. Quote, "The issue of whether the universe is purposive is an ultimate question that is at the back of everybody's mind. And Dr. Ashen has now raised exactly the same question as to whether the universe is a product of thought. And I have to say that that is also my personal opinion. But I can't back it up by too much of a precise argument. There are very many aspects of the universe where you have to either say there have been monstrous coincidences, which there might have been, or alternately, there is a purposeful scenario to which the universe conforms. As I said earlier, I'm psychologically incapable of believing the universe is purposeless. So unlike Fred Hoyle, I'm not sitting on the fence. Let me simply say that the sheer beauty of the heavens declares the glory of God." Scientist and God. And our scientist for this issue is Charles Townes, who just passed away this year. Prize-winning physicist who invented the laser and pioneered its use in astronomy. And Dr. Townes said this, "To me, God is a personal yet omnipresent, a great source of strength. He has made an enormous difference to me. Life may be very improbable, but it did happen. And it happened in accordance with physical laws. And physical laws are laws that God made. Science and religion are often viewed as separate aspects of our beliefs and understanding. But religion is an attempt to understand the purpose of our universe, and science an attempt to understand its nature and characteristics. So the two are necessarily related. Religion, with its theological reflection, builds on faith. Science, too, builds on faith. How? For successful science of the type we know, we must have faith that the universe is governed by reliable laws, and further, that these laws can be discovered by human inquiry. The logic of human inquiry is trustworthy only if nature itself is logical. Science operates with the faith that human logic can, in the long run, understand nature's laws, and that they are dependable. This is the lesson, or the faith, of reason. I think all of science, in a sense, comes from belief in order in the universe. That's part of scientific faith, that there is order and reliability, and so on. That's part of the Judeo-Christian tradition, that there is one God. In my view, the question of origin seems to be left unanswered. If we explore from a scientific view alone, thus I believe there is a need for some religious or metaphysical explanation. I believe in the concept of God and his existence. Cynthia's Corner by Cynthia Clayton. The heavens declare the glory of God. I'm not an apologist like my husband, nor am I scientifically trained like he is. Still, I can see and understand the heavens declare the glory of God and the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Psalms 19:1. Romans 1, beginning with verse 19, says, "What may be known about God is plain to us, and God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood from what has been made." We can look at the creation that God has made and see the wisdom and design in it. John has a lesson about the mathematical improbabilities of the creation and our world in it, all coming into existence by chance. Our existence on the earth and in our solar system and our galaxy is dependent on so many variables that have to be precisely what they are, and therefore carefully designed, in order for us to exist. However, anyone can look up to the heavens and be in awe of the splendor and unfathomable vastness of the universe. When John and I go on our Canyonlands tour, John is enthralled by the complexities of the geologic processes that produced the Grand Canyon, the Hoodoos in Bryce Canyon, the cross-bedded sandstone in Zion National Park, and the petrified logs in the petrified forest. I may not understand all of the processes that God used to create them, but I can appreciate the end result of God's designs and admire their beauty and diversity. You don't have to be a scientist to recognize and appreciate the complexity, diversity, beauty, and design seen throughout all of God's creation. There are many scientists who have come to believe in an intelligent creator because of the things he has made. Albert Einstein said, quote, "Religious feeling takes the form of a rapturous amazement at the harmony of natural law, which reveals an intelligence of such superiority that compared with it, all the systematic acting and thinking of human beings is insignificant." Watch out for flying snakes. Dandy designs. I suppose this article may bring nightmares to some folks, but there actually is a snake that flies. The snake is called the paradise tree snake, or if you like scientific names, it is Chrysopelea paradisi, or Chrysopelea ornata, the ornate flying snake. Like flying squirrels, we all know and enjoy in America, the paradise tree snake is actually a glider. If you saw the snake sitting on the branch of a tree, it would look like any other snake. When it gets ready to fly, the snake anchors its tail on a branch, and the front part of its body drops down and then shoots up and out, head first. Meanwhile, the snake's ribs splay out and its stomach is pulled in, making a dome-shaped parachute like a mushroom cap. Researchers at Virginia Tech have found that this shape gives substantial lift to the snake, but the total lift is more than this change in shape alone could allow. One proposal is that the motion of the snake in the air causes drafting, which increases lift, similar to what bicycle and car racers do. The snake can actually glide over 60 feet when leaping from a 30-foot height. The design of the body, the rib structure, the way the snake launches itself, all bring complex engineering into the picture. The question of why this behavior is in the snake got an interesting answer when the head researcher of the snake noticed that when an airplane flew over the area where the snake was living, the snake popped up its head and followed the airplane across the sky. The obvious need for gliding behavior is to aid escape from predatory birds, which find this non-venomous snake to be easy prey. You can construct a possible chance scenario for this behavior by saying that the snakes that can fly survive, and those that can't, don't. However, to have the right equipment to be able to fly is as much of an issue as is the instinctive desire to do so. Another proposal is to keep balance in nature. God has designed instinctive survival behaviors into all forms of life and created equipment to make those behaviors possible. The data is from Science News, March-April 2014, page 4. Designing a predator. We often overlook how complicated it is to keep a balance in nature. We see a video of an animal killing another animal and recoil in distaste at the violence and the death of what appears to be an innocent animal. We fail to realize how important it is for predators to exist. Without predators, the plant-eating animals would quickly eat all of the plants, and not only would they starve to death, but all life would eventually cease to exist. Maintaining balance between the food supply and the animals that depend upon that food supply is very complicated. Nowhere is this more true than in the insect world. If we didn't have animals that feed on insects, the bugs in the creation would create ecological havoc. One of the best designed bug eaters is the dragonfly. Dragonflies eat incredible numbers of flies, and researchers have found that the design of the dragonfly allows this to happen. There is a circuit of 16 neurons that connect the dragonfly's brain to its flight motor center in the thorax. This allows the dragonfly to track a moving target and intercept it. Robert Alberg, in a recent issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Science, has shown how the dragonfly uses vector mechanics in such a way that the image of the prey is always in the same spot in the retina of the eye, allowing 100% sure contact with the target. Dragonflies can hover, dive, fly backward and upside down, and pivot 360 degrees. They can reach speeds of 30 miles per hour, and their eyes are giant spheres with 30,000 pixel-like facets that allow them to see every direction at once. With all this hardware, the dragonfly brain is very simple, having less than a million neurons. Human brains have 100 billion neurons. The dragonfly is a well-designed insect eater that keeps a balance in nature among insects. Lions catch 25% of their prey, and great white sharks about 50%. But the kill ratio for dragonflies is essentially 100%. Proverbs 8 proclaims God's wisdom and calls us to understand the wisdom we see in every corner of the creation. Does not wisdom call out? Does not understanding raise your voice? You who are simple, gain prudence. You who are foolish, gain understanding. Listen, for I, wisdom, have worthy things to say. End of quote. Designing a planet that can last for years is incredibly complicated. And the design of predators like the dragonfly speak of a God whose intelligence and knowledge of engineering principles is infinite. The data for this article is from National Wildlife, August-September 2014, page 32. News and notes. What happens in the first year is profound. That is the opening line of an incredible article in National Geographic, January 2015, page 59. The article is subtitled, A Baby's Brain Needs Love to Develop. We have emphasized the importance of the nuclear family for over 40 years now, and our arguments have been mostly from personal experience and observation. This article gives solid scientific data to support God's plan for the home. This is done by EEG brain patterns and exhaustive studies of children deprived of contact with their parents or other adult caregivers. In Romania in the 1960s, the communist government pushed families to put their children into a state-run daycare so their mothers and fathers could work in government factories. The daycares had 15 to 20 children per caregiver. The only attention the children got was when they were being fed or bathed. The brain waves of 136 of these children were studied by neuroscientists. One researcher said it was as if a dimmer switch had been used to turn their brain activity down. Half of the kids were placed in foster families at age 2 and showed remarkable recovery. Numerous other studies are reported, as well as a detailed explanation of how the brain develops during the first year of life. This is an important article for people working with families and for families themselves to read. DNA design. Imagine packing a string of the length of 2 football fields into a sphere the size of the point of a pin. The designer of DNA had that kind of a problem to solve. DNA stretched out would be roughly 6 feet long. The designer of the cell had to compress that 6 feet into a nucleus, which is about 5 micrometers, or roughly 0.00002 inches in diameter. Atheist as ministers. The Freedom From Religion Foundation, an atheist group originally from Madison, Wisconsin, has been engaged in a number of lawsuits to challenge tax breaks for churches and ministers. In December 2014, the Seventh Court of Appeals overturned a lower court's decision that ministers' housing allowances, which had been allowed for 60 years, were unconstitutional. The Department of Justice argued that atheists would qualify as ministers of the gospel under IRS guidelines. The word gospel in the government's view is any good news, and being free from religion would qualify. Reference for that is Christianity Today, January, February 2015, page 16. ACLU finally gets something right, or did it? The ACLU's Michigan branch filed a brief in support of Bible believers for an instant in December of 2012. That announcement, released by the Associated Press on December 27, 2014, and widely publicized in newspapers in Michigan, might sound like the ACLU has finally decided not to continue attacking churches and believers in God. The title of the article in the papers was, quote, ACLU Stands by Evangelist, end of quote. The fact is that Bible Believers is a radical denominational group which hurls hate-filled messages at anyone who doesn't share their views. In 2012, they carried a pig's head into a Muslim festival screaming that Dearborn atheists were all going to burn in hell. Sheriff's deputies told them to leave, which they refused to do, and thus were ticketed. The brief by the ACLU claims that free speech is an issue, that they have taken no such stance when reputable Christians have spoken up against abortion, prostitution, or drug-related issues. It appears that this was just another way for atheists to bash Christians. Lifestyles of Pop Stars. The Week, December 31, 2014, page 9, reported on a study showing that the lifespans of popular musicians is roughly 25 years shorter than on the average. Dr. Diana Kinney, looked at 12,000 popular musicians who died from 1950 to 2014 and found that early death was common. Kenny says the culprit is a culture that glorifies outrageous behavior by emotionally immature artists. The pop scene is toxic and needs rehabilitation. When our children and grandchildren get enamored with the current rock star, they need to understand that it is likely that rock star will die in their 50s, not in their 70s or 80s. The Bible's warnings about evil companions are truths we need to listen to. Want to buy a church building? The Wall Street Journal recently published a study by Pew Research Center of what used to be called the Church of St. Joseph in Arnhem, Netherlands. This church once had 1,000 in attendance every Sunday, but now it is a skate hall with an obstacle course and jumps. Those in attendance are children on skateboards. The article goes on to tell about the number of churches closed in Europe. In Denmark, less than 10% of the population attend any church service, and some 200 churches are up for sale. The Catholic Church has closed 515 churches in Germany since 2005. Holland expects to close 700 churches by 2020. Governments of European countries are trying to sell the church properties, but most of the structures are beyond recovery and not useful for much of anything in the 21st century. Our experience with our lectureships in Europe has been that people desperately want to believe, but they have never been shown the evidence for God's existence and the validity of Christianity. What people don't want is man-made churches who play around with the notion of faith, but don't live it. A new origin of life theory. Jeremy England is a physicist at MIT who has invented a new explanation as to how life began and why life exists here upon the earth. The theory is called dispensation-driven organization. Life exists, according to England, because living groups of atoms tend to be better at capturing energy from their environment and dissipating that energy as heat than are non-living groups of atoms. Changes in biological systems, according to England, are controlled by what physical constraints are easiest to achieve. This simple explanation of a complex presentation is being hailed as a new way to think, and there will be debate about this idea for years to come. We would point out that this has no connection to the question of God's creation. The creation of space and time and matter energy is not addressed in this theory. The conditions that allow groupings of atoms have to be very carefully chosen and controlled. The laws of physics being employed, especially the second law of thermodynamics, are carefully crafted to be the architects of life. Could this be a method God designed to fashion life? Certainly that is possible, and future years of research and study have answered that. But it is not a threat to faith in God as the Creator. Reference to that is Natalie Walkover in Quantum Magazine, December 8, 2014. Peer review scams. In order to get research accepted or taken seriously in the scientific community, there has to be peer review. What that means is the people who have academic credentials in the area of research being reported have to review the data and the report and indicate whether it has credibility and should be taken seriously and accepted as valid research. There have been times in the past when a scientist who was known for his Christian beliefs had his professional work ignored because he simply couldn't get peer review accomplished, sometimes apparently caused by the fact that the reviewers didn't share his religious views. In Nature magazine, 2014-515, pages 480, there is an article by Ferguson, Marcus, and Oransky on peer review in recent years. Religion, politics, science have all had problems with dishonest members of their associations violating ethics and using scams to accomplish their own ends. In Discover magazine, January-February 2015, page 20, there is another article by Marcus and Oransky titled The Urine Fraud. They have also founded a website called www.retractionwatch.com to deal with this subject. Alien life form discovered. We define life in high school textbooks as that which can eat, move, breathe, reproduce, and respond to outside stimuli. In the past 50 years, we've discovered some bizarre forms of life. There are forms of life that can survive in extreme conditions of temperature and pressure, such as tardigrades, deep sea bacteria, and shrimp that live in and near sea vents. All of these fit the definition of life forms, even though it may be hydrogen sulfide they depend on instead of oxygen. Kenneth Nielsen at the University of Southern California has been researching a microbe that essentially eats and breathes electricity. These bacteria power themselves with electric charge. The bacteria get electrons from sources in their area, usually carbohydrates. They then release electrons to metallic oxides in the area, completing the circuit. This isn't really alien life because it has been found on Earth and has been here from the beginning. It offers ways of providing all kinds of environmental and agricultural advances. It is just one more example of design features that God has created to allow ecosystems to flourish, even when all that is present is rocks and minerals. For more information on this, see Popular Science, February 2015, pages 32 through 39. Where did Noah land? One of the main points of this journal is that if the Bible is taken literally, all conflict between science and the Bible disappear. Taking the Bible literally means looking at who wrote it, who they wrote it to, why they wrote it, and how people of the time would have understood it. The word Ararat in Hebrew literally means creation or holy land. People of Moses' day would have understood it as the district of Armenia, between the river Araxes and the lakes Van and Urumbia. Rather obviously, the singular Mount Ararat of today was not the mount that the Bible is describing. In Jeremiah 51:27, we have mention of Ararat as a kingdom. Claims of finding the ark through the centuries have always been proven to be erroneous, and recent claims are also likely to be untrue, because the researchers are on the wrong side of the mountain. Rather than trying to find the ark, perhaps researchers should be trying to understand the message of the flood account. Reference for that is Bible History Daily, November 27, 2014. Divorces for the elderly surge. The divorce rate for people over 50 has doubled in the last 20 years. In 2010, 25% of all divorces were for people over 50. God hates divorce, Malachi 2:16. And anyone who has been divorced can tell you why. Not only is there emotional and psychological pain involved in divorce, but the ripple effect upon families is huge. In addition, the average loss of income for a man is 23% and for a woman is 41%. More of an issue for the church is why this is happening. The ease of getting divorces is one factor, but it also has to do with the weakening of faith, commitment, and involvement of seniors in spiritual activities and work. The world's values and the pressure to look after number one have rubbed off on us. The weakness of faith in what the church teaches is a major contributor. The data for that is from AARP Magazine, November 2014, page 16. Ocean water, not from comets. An amazing display of human intelligence and engineering was accomplished late in 2014 when the Rosetta spacecraft visited comets and was able to measure the makeup of water in the coma of the comet. Water on Earth contains a small amount of deuterium, which is hydrogen that has a neutron associated with the proton that makes up the nucleus. Ordinary hydrogen is just a proton and an electron. The water on the comet had three times as much of deuterium, and that suggests that the comets did not bring water to the Earth, at least not this type of comet. In 1986, the Giotto spacecraft flew through the coma of Halley's Comet and had a very high level of deuterium as well. It appears the water on the Earth was in some way specially formed during the creation of the Earth. The repeated references to water in Genesis 1 would support that idea. God could certainly use comets to produce water, but it is another support for the integrity of the biblical account. That data is from Science News, January 10, 2015, page 8. Does religion cause war? Atheists have harped on the religious conflicts that have racked the planet during most of human existence as a reason to destroy religious belief. Dr. Karen Armstrong is a respected historian and has written a widely acclaimed book titled The Battle for God, in which she shows that virtually all human conflict has been the quest for power, money, territory, and glory, with religion playing a distant second as a cause. She also shows that the ancient religions exhorted the faithful to care selflessly for all human beings as their brother and sisters. She also shows that much of the time religion has been only a veneer used to legitimize the power struggle. The review of this book can be found in The Week, November 4, 2014, page 24. And that's the end of the Does God Exist bi-monthly journal for May-June 2015. I hope that the warmer weather and the beauty of summer is coming your way, and that we will see you again in 2 months as we read the July-August issue of the Does God Exist bi-monthly journal. This is John Clayton wishing you the best.